Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, 1st chapter, text number 32, The Activities of Maharaj Priyavrata. Jambuplaksa salmani kusa kruncha sakka puskara sangyastesham parimanam purvasmat uttara uttaro yata sankhyam dviguna manena bahi samantata upakliptaha jambu jambu plaksa plaksa shalmali salmali mali kusha kusha kruncha shaka shaka Pushka, Pushka, Samgya, known as Tisam, of them, Parimanam, measurement, Purvasmat, Purvasmat, from the former, Uttara Uttara, the following, Yata, according to, Sankhyam, number. Dviguna, twice as much. Manena, with a measure. Bahi, outside. Samantata, all around. Upaklipta, produced. Translation. The names of the islands are Jambu, Plaksa, Salmali, Kusha, Kroncha, Shaka, and Pushkara. Each island is twice as large as the one preceding it, and each is surrounded by a liquid substance beyond which is the next island. Purport. The ocean in each planetary system has a different type of liquid. How they are situated is explained in the next verse. So here we are in a technical portion of the Srimad Bhagavatam with a description of the universe by the Vedic conception. So the Vedic literatures, when we speak here about islands or dvipa, they actually mean different planetary systems. And it speaks of oceans, how there are oceans surrounding these areas or on these areas, and oceans made of different substances. Oceans of water, oceans of milk, and other substances. Maybe, again, yesterday I spoke about Priyavrata, who was a powerful personality, much more powerful than a human being, or than a common human being, because Priyavrata drove in a chariot in the sky and was able to light up the sky just as the sun would do. And in this way, there was no night in the kingdom. It said that the wheels of Priyavrata divided the universe in various planetary systems. So then we spoke at length about mythology, you know, and how this looks like mythology. There are so many mythological explanations of the universe, right? In ancient traditions. So it looks like that. However, Srila Prabhupada taught us that we should not see this as some mythological imaginary story, but rather that these are factual, detailed descriptions of how things came into being. And that the Bhagavatam in that way must be taken as describing the universe, the real thing. So yes, different oceans of different substances. Tomorrow there will be a whole list. There are even, but I'll give you one already, or two, let's say. I said milk, I gave you. There are also sweet oceans, sweet drinking water oceans, not only salty ones. And there's also one planet with an ocean of liquor. So certain people would certainly want to go there. I can just imagine how much they would be attracted to. That would be the dream of life come true, right? Of course. So how is it? Well, it shows a principle. And the principle is that the universe is not created by the will of the Lord, or not by the desire of the Lord. This universe is created by the desire of the living entities, and the Supreme Lord, who is the Supreme Controller, reciprocating with those desires, and to some extent fulfilling them, and to some extent also frustrating them. After all, the purpose of the Supreme Lord is to educate the living being. The purpose of the Supreme Lord is to bring the living being back to transcendental knowledge, divyajnanam. And this transcendental knowledge, divyajnanam, is knowledge about, first of all, our own position, aham brahmasmi, that we are eternal spirit soul, and Krishna nityadas, and that we are in our eternal situation, an eternal soul within a temporary body. So that changes already priority a lot in life, if we are suddenly eternal soul and not the temporary body. Then the next level is that as the eternal soul, we are the eternal servant of Krishna. See, we're serving Krishna right now because we're always working with Krishna's energy. Everything we do, we want to have many things, we want to move many things, we want to go places, but all these places are Krishna's energy. All these things that we are moving is Krishna's energy. So, really, all these things we want to control and have, so-called have, which means control, is Krishna's energy. And it's clear. Just like that story that Prabhupada told in Mayapur to a wealthy Indian businessman who had a factory in manufacturing glass. So then Srila Prabhupada asked a question. He said, where is glass coming from? The man said, from silicium, and a chemical silicium. And Prabhupada said, where are you getting that? He said, from sand. And Prabhupada said, where are you getting the sand? Well, since a sadhu was speaking, naturally, the man then said, from God. So then Prabhupada said, yes, that's right. And therefore you are a thief. And man is like a rich man, you know. He's just telling him straight to his face. And therefore you are a thief. So it's like, he's not used to that. People usually, you know, speak nice things to rich people, right? And so, you know, so the man says, I'm a thief. And Prabhupada said, yes, you are a thief. You took what belongs to someone else. You change it a little bit and you sell it in the market. That's the business of a thief. Right? So in this way, the man was like, well, then he admitted it, you know, yes, I am a thief. And that is a fact. In Sanskrit, stena, it is said that all are thieves. Big thieves and little thieves. That is all. Right? So, that is our situation. We are also thieves. We know that already. That's not news. But, you know, small thieves, big thieves. But really, we're stealing away what belongs to Krishna for ourselves. That's what our position is. So the true way of life is a way of giving, not a way of taking. The way of taking is called the way of Kripana Falahitava, or the way that
everything is meant for me, the miser. And whereas the Brahmana, who is has a transcendental vision, a Brahmana who is always looking at the spiritual, eternal reality, that is Brahmana. So the Brahmana, it is concerned with the eternal reality. He is very generous. That is his main quality, that generosity. So this we have to develop, giving rather than taking. Giving our life in service rather than trying to be controller, master, enjoyer. But of course that goes very much against the modern world. They always say, enjoy, right? Enjoy. Everywhere, it's about enjoying, us enjoying. Are you enjoying? I hope you're enjoying. Are you enjoying? That's very important. Yes, that is very important that you're enjoying. I really hope. I mean, otherwise, what is life meant for? But enjoying. So, but if you look at it more objectively, then you see that some people are enjoying and some people are not enjoying at all. Yeah? Objectively speaking, if you just look around, some are having a great time and some are having a miserable time. So, oh, poor guy, you know, like so much bad luck and, you know, really feel really sorry for you. Car, you know, wheelchair, yeah? And has a miserable life. Yeah. I have one disciple who lives his life in a wheelchair and it's tough. Since he was quite young, he lived in a wheelchair. So tough, you know. Just trying to make the best of it, but has his moments of depression, which is quite understandable. Depression is a big thing, you know, in the world. Not that I want to talk about depression so much, but my point is that to just say enjoy looks a little simplistic, looks like a little naive, right? And if you're more sober and more realistic, then you see that it's not all just beautiful. It's also sometimes really tough. A devotee, because a devotee has a positive inspiration, because a devotee has this devotional service, that is something very nice. That is a jewel. That is something precious. It's something positive. You know? And if you have something positive, even if everything else is sometimes good and sometimes not good, but if you have something really valuable and positive, then you get so much good energy from that, it rains anyway. You know, Singing in the Rain, it's a classical movie. But that's really the Hare Krishnas. You've seen him singing in the rain many times. Maybe even last night, although maybe not. Was close. Almost last night, almost singing in the rain. So like that, we can do. We can do. I remember I was in one Ratiyatra, in a small town somewhere, and it was raining, serious raining. And I had to give a speech from the chariot at the beginning of the festival, and I still remember it because it was everyone with umbrellas and rain ponchos and so on, me too. And I was saying that, yes, it is raining like anything. And we are now about to go on a ratayatra, on a parade, in all this rain. And it is raining so much. But one thing I must say, that the rain of mercy is bigger than the rain of water. And then we went for it. And yes, the rain of mercy of Lord Jagannath. And we started to go in the rain, buckets of rain. I mean, there was so much water, fish were swimming past. That's how it was. Serious. Boy, oh boy. But we transcended it. We started dancing and we were just ecstatic in that ratiyatra. And it was one of the best ratiyatras I've been to, really. I mean, it was so special. There was such an atmosphere. Everyone just thought, to hell with it, and just started dancing like mad, swimming, practically speaking. Anyway, so that's how devotional service can change everything in this world. It is the one positive element that is so ultra-positive that everything else, who cares? It's like, you get a little wet and you dry later. No problem. Yes. No problem. So this understanding is, for a devotee, is not intellectual. It's not that he sort of looks at the world and says, well, actually it's not so bad because Krishna is behind it and Krishna is all good. That's intellectual and philosophical. But devotional service is such a thing that it's actually realized within the heart. One experiences it. Because it gives so much satisfaction. So vaipumso parodharmo yata bhaktiya dokshate haitikya bhatiyata yayatma supersedati. Pure devotional service can fully satisfy the heart. And of course, it takes some time before we come to pure devotional service. But even in the initial stages, it's already offering satisfaction to the heart. And more so. So it's a positive thing which transforms our whole life. And it doesn't require that you change everything in your life. See, it doesn't require that you become a sannyasi like I did, and go through the world in a saffron dress with lots of flower garlands, and this is a good one, but there are flower garlands where all the petals fall off all the time. Yeah. And then I was in South Africa one year on an airport, and in South Africa there was in the past this apartheid, but like rich whites and very poor blacks. And it's of course still a little bit like that, So I was walking on the airport and I left a trail of petals everywhere. And then this black cleaning lady, she started to walk behind me and sweep it all up. I felt really embarrassed, Here I'm walking with this black slave. It looked like that, Oh my God, I felt, how do I get rid of this garland, Can't throw it in the bin. Anyway, so who would want to be a sannyasi? Who would want to do something so strange? Renounce the world, give up by vow all enjoyment in this world. Come on, just a little? No, nothing. Little. Little is no problem. Come on, we can't be fanatic. No, nothing. Who would want to take such a vow? One who wants to take such a vow is one who obviously is relishing the spiritual side. Spiritual life is something like this. We take a step on our legs. And if you take a step, first the weight is on one of your body, is on one leg. And then, as you move forward, you put the weight of the body on the other leg, isn't it? So, it is in spiritual life, it's like this, that first the weight is on the material side. We take to spiritual life, but we sort of put our toe out a little bit, but no serious weight on that spiritual foot yet. Then, as we are getting more faith that, okay, I'm on solid ground here. We lean forward in spiritual life and we begin to put all the weight on the spiritual foot. And gradually, there is no more weight on the material foot. And then we are in this world only, yeah, externally. Internally, we are always in the spiritual world. Internally, we are just remembering our relationship with Krishna in the spiritual world. And, you know, yeah, we are here, and we see it all. Okay. Sort of, could be better weather. Right? No, I'm saying it's like, you know, it could be. So, but looking at it, but let it go. Yeah, let it go. Seeing nice things, you know. Yeah. Temple is fixed up. The altar is blue, looks cool. Yeah. You know. Last time I was here, it wasn't blue. So, nice. Nice things. But one is internally peaceful. One who is having the weight on the spiritual leg is internally peaceful, because such a person is living in the spiritual world, internally, in his heart, in Vrindavan, with Krishna. So, all right, you know, whatever happens on the physical platform, that is, you know, is going on, right, and that's all right. And then it says in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Jnanitaham savijnanam idam vakshami asesitaha yajgyatvaneya bhuvanyats gyatavam avasisyate. And it says in that in this Bhagavad Gita, I'm supplying you with knowledge. Knowledge about the spiritual world and knowledge about the material world. Both. And now nothing remains to be known. Well, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, it gives knowledge about the material world, but maybe not as detailed as scientific knowledge nowadays. Scientific knowledge, you know, like analyzes everything with a microscope and this scope and that scope, and is trying to analyze in so many elements and this and that, and they're getting better at it, and you know, more amazing things they're finding out, and what they don't know nowadays, and it's like, you know, they're developing medicines that can do amazing things, and that are one pill that is released gradually in the body is like, whew, amazing. So what can be said? It looks like the Bhagavad Gita is not that detailed in its knowledge. So, how can one say that now nothing further remains to be known about the material world? Well, because the Bhagavad Gita describes the essential nature of the material world. And that's all we need to know. See, if we just figure it out, like, what's the purpose of it all? You know, what's the meaning of life? What are we doing it all for? That's important to know. It's like there is a first of all, people used to be religious, right? And then there were many priests and in different cultures and countries and traditions, and these priests, they would all say that if you don't act according to the religious book, whatever the book was, yeah, then you will go to hell. Yeah. And then sometimes detailed descriptions of hell. The finger, raising a finger, and hell, and all that. So an element of fear. Fear was instilled in the people by the priests. And the idea was that on fear of hell, people would behave in a moral way. Yeah. So that is the lower approach. You know, that's the animal. That's how you deal with an animal. Yeah? You know, nowadays, of course, we don't really drive horse carts anymore. You know, we have cars with a lot of horsepower, but you sort of remember it or see it. We've all seen it on TV. How, you know, they have a whip or a stick or something, you know, to kind of put some fear into the animal. That when I tell you to go left, you know, the animal thinks, why would I go left? Bats! Okay, I got it. I should go left. I don't want that. So, fear. If we base spiritual life on fear, then we have the lowest level of spiritual life. A higher approach to spirituality is when we are looking for the positive energy. So we see in primitive religions, and even in other religions, you see this element of fear, and sometimes we see like worshipping all kinds of deities, you know, like, and making offerings, like, you know, in some parts of India they have a deity, a female deity that controls smallpox, right? And then so all making offerings, you know, hoping, you know, no one gets the smallpox. Okay, well, you know, offer your flower and put a few rupees on the altar. It's just you know, sort of your health insurance. You know what I mean? It's basically a form of health insurance. That's all it is. Yeah. So that is a lower form of worship. When we are worshipping for material benefit, then if we start to look at energies, positive energies, the life-giving force of the sun, then our meditation is a little better, because we are not worshipping out of fear, but we have a positive attitude. So the one who worships out of fear is the Shakta. Shaktas, Durgama, Kalima, yes, or modern science. The Suryas, worshipping the positive energy of the sun. But that also includes prana, yeah, chi, or, you know, reiki, or earth lines, yes, like, you know, and all these kind of things, right? That's basically tapping into cosmic energies. So that's the second level of spirituality. It's still on the low side. But then the third level of spirituality, one level up, is the level where one begins to realize that there are personal deities, and that it's not just about impersonal energy, but that there are personal deities. But one approaches these deities for material benefit. And it's like in the Indian Vedic culture, especially Ganapati. Ganapati, aha. Yes, the deity of the Vaishyas. Make a little bit of offering and then get blessings. He takes away all the obstacles. Yes, yes. But of the short-term, immediate material goal. So, materially motivated religion. Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? And so on. See, that's all within that realm. So that's the third level. But when it's approaching a personal deity, it's better than worshipping out of fear, better than going for the energies, if one worships a personality, but with fruitive desire. Higher than that is that we understand that the essence of spirituality is not in this world, and that the essence is in an eternal world. But at the same time, one does not have any information about that spiritual realm. And one thinks that whatever is spiritual cannot be material. So whatever the qualities are of matter, that cannot be there in spirit. So when there's form in matter, then there will be no form in spirit. See the logic? So in this way, they come to a conclusion that the ultimate spiritual reality is impersonal, because they basically say, what is spirit must be the opposite of matter, or spirit is non-matter. Yeah. So there's a logic there. But the logic is faulty, incomplete, because matter matter is also from spiritual origin. This world is actually based on spiritual energy. So actually, matter doesn't really exist. It is another form of spiritual energy. Here is the ever-changing form of spiritual energy, and there is the constant form of spiritual energy. But it's all Krishna's energy. So, the top, and that, in the Vedic culture, that level of worship is happening with the Shaivites. That level of worship is also found in personalism, in Islam. Yeah. Impersonalism was also there in Western philosophers. And it is interesting that in the late 50s and early 60s, when the hippie movement was being born, it started in the 50s with beatniks, right? And beatniks were sort of young people who were protesting against modern society. They had a punkish element in them, and they were also looking for... they're looking at the East. They're looking at Zen Buddhism and a bit from India and this, that. And they started to experiment with drugs. Now, there was a writer named Aldous Huxley. Aldous Huxley, who wrote a book in 1945 called The Doors of Perception. And this book was describing an LSD experience. Yeah. So Aldous Huxley was like an original LSD prophet. And the book of Aldous Huxley became like one of the Bibles of the hippie generation. Yeah. Like in the 60s, you had to, if you hadn't read The Doors of Perception, I mean, you were a square, you know, a total square. Yeah. I remember, I read it. Yeah. I read it, you had to read it, you know. It's like if you didn't read it, gosh, you know, you were nobody. Right? And the Beatles sang, Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Yeah. And the LSD culture was setting in. And so Aldous Huxley's book became like the philosophy of the thing. And the interesting thing of Aldous Huxley's book was that there was a spiritual experience in his LSD, and that he was looking for God. But at the same time, hardcore, impersonal concept of God was in there. So actually the hippie movement started off from in the West with impersonalism. And then in India, when they finally went to India, the Babas were already waiting. Yes, 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 it is all one. Ah, yes. Because India also has its equivalents thereof. See, in India, there are various levels of understanding of impersonalism. One level is the level of Shiva worship. Why is Shiva worship linked to impersonalism? Because in Shiva worship, there is the lingam. And the lingam is representing the male influence and the female influence. At the base is an oval shape representing the prakriti, the material energy, like the female shape. And then a column, a phallus symbol for the male influence. And this lingam is being widely worshipped in India. Always people pouring water on the lingam and so on. That is every day. Now, what is the idea? The idea is that Krishna expands himself into various forms of Narayan, and then it goes on, and then we get the form of Mahavishnu. From the form, It is said that when the material energy is not yet created, at that time, Mahavishnu glances on the potential of the material world. Sadashiva becomes that glance and enters into the potential, the pradana it is called, the potential of the material energy. And then all the living beings are placed in there. So in this way, the material energy comes into motion. Everything becomes literally impregnated. Right? So by Shambhu, by Shiva, by the Shambhu form, the material energy becomes impregnated with living beings. And activate. Then the matter is activated. And then the whole thing begins. You know, the whole game starts. Some form of roulette, some form of gambling, which we are playing here. How will it turn out? I don't know. I'm gonna win. Maybe. Maybe not. So, the impersonalist then is thinking that for some time all these forms are manifest and then they again stop to exist, as Shiva is also the destroyer. So in this way, impersonalists generally worship Shiva. They see that behind Shiva, that impersonal idea. And it was very convenient in India, because in India there are so many religions, so many different gods are being worshipped and so many deities are being worshipped. And, you know, it is no problem. It is no problem. First of all, the idea is that all these different deities are manifestations of the impersonal, which is behind it. And they all come from there. So that's fine then. So whether you worship this deity or that deity, it's all good. All good. Because it all leads to the higher ultimate goal. And people, they want blessings. And that is why in the more popular impersonal belief, you may see an altar and every deity is on the altar. It is as packed as the Indian trains. Yeah? The altar is it's for the Indian devotee to enjoy this joke. But it is as packed as the altars are as packed as the Indian train. Because the idea is, well, you know, we may as well put this deity on the altar also. Yes? Because you never know. You never know. You might get some blessings. Yeah? So if there is some Baba or some Guru, put the picture, put the picture. Put all the pictures, everything, because you never know. Ah, you might get some benefit. Ah, yes, get some blessings. So we are putting. Ah. So this is going on, right? And that's why Indian altars, or in the general populace, are sometimes as packed as Indian trains. Well, what to do? But all this is incomplete. It is not understanding Advaya Gyan, which is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam, which is Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavan Iti Sabjate, that the Supreme Lord is manifesting in three ways. In a personal form, in the form of his super soul within the heart, and in the form of his energies. Then, the devotees understand the personality is the most important. Isn't it for us also like that? Your money or your life? It's difficult. Difficult choice, but in the end, most people would give their money. Cry a little. Take the money. Because life is more valuable. Yes. So the person is more important than the energy, than the things, ultimately, for most people. So that's a fact. In the Supreme Lord, the person is the most important. And then we say, first, the highest is the personality of Godhead, Krishna. Ishvara Paramakrishna Satsidananda Vigrapish. And then from him emanate all his energies. And Brahman is also his energy. That's not understood. Shakti Parinamavat. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that the energy is, that Brahman is is not the Supreme Lord, but that it is the energy of the Supreme Lord, and that the Lord manifests himself in that energy, but cannot say that Brahman is the Lord. It's interesting. Hiranmayena patrena satyasyupitam mukam tattvam pusana pavlinu satyadharmaratishyate. This Upanishad says the same thing. It says, take away this dazzling effulgence and show me your real face behind. So in this way we understand that actually impersonalism is incomplete. But I just gave a little history how it was existing in the West and with the hippie generation, and therefore, and you can see how much it is. And we are very impersonal. Then Christianity, it used to have some personal deities like angels and all these things, right? And, but not so many, right? Not as many as India, or not as many as Greece, or not as many as the other European traditions, who had all kinds of deities behind everything, controlling the wind, the rain, in South America, all over the world. But then, yeah, we see that Christianity got rid of that. No, there's only one God. And like in India also, people sometimes take to Christianity because it's so simple. Oh, only one God. Okay, very simple. Only one. So in India, so many, but all this puja, that puja, God, all these pujas, you know. But only one puja. It's much cheaper. So, in this way, some people take to it. And they give you also a house, brick house. Yes. Good, very generous Christians. You join them, they give you everything. It's good. Anyway, so... oh, and what did I say about that argument that that whatever is spirit cannot be matter? And therefore one way of defining spirit is as non-matter, or that spirit cannot have the qualities of matter. What about that philosophy? No, no, no. That's also incorrect. The correct understanding is found in Platonian writings. Plato established this idea that the material world is a reflection of the original spiritual world. Right? And that is exactly the fact of the matter. That is how it is. It's a reflection. And in this way, we have in this lecture gone step by step over different levels of spirituality, and I summarize them just one more time, just so that we get a clear picture. The lowest level, the Shakta, worshipping Durga and worshipping Kali, trying to pacify the angry material nature, or tribal people making animal sacrifice, even human sacrifice. The Lord wants blood, the gods up there want blood, give them blood so that they don't take our blood. Yes, good idea. Worship out of fear. Then we have the positive energy, the solar worship. You see, I gave the example of the Reiki and all those things, but I may also give the example of chi. You know, you see these Chinese movies and they cook eggs with chi, you know. So much power they have in their hands. These karate guys, just like throw a chi ball and the opponent flies 3 meters away through the sky. Never even touched him. Wow. That's a Zen master far out. So all that is sort of playing with energies. Then the higher level was approaching a personal deity for material benefits. So that's small-mindedness, but at least approaching a personal deity. Higher than that was accepting the eternal world as more important than this temporary world and putting one's focus there, but unfortunately with an impersonal understanding of what is spirit. And then the highest level is that we understand the personality. And because the material is a reflection of the spiritual, therefore we see we have the same values here. persons are more important than things. And therefore we can understand that Krishna consciousness, the idea that Krishna or the Supreme Lord is a person and is behind everything, is very logical and very natural. It is not necessary to make all kinds of artificial philosophical arrangements. Say that you have a philosophy, it's all one. Try to cross the street. Yeah, it's all one. Why are you looking left and right? Why are you looking? Once you look, after look, some cars may come, but it's all one. Yeah, but you know, you don't really want, you know, that you become one with the car and the road, is it? When the car drives over you. So there are these little... So if you have this impersonal philosophy, you test it in a practical way, then it doesn't work, that it's all one, because we don't relate to it like that. So it's some sort of artificial adjustment to be made. But Krishna consciousness applies perfectly on the spiritual level and on the material level. So that makes it very, not theoretical, but also practical. Also something you can see here on the earth, and something you can see there in the eternal spiritual realm. And therefore, it's pretty interesting. Okay, that was enough. Phew, so early in the morning. Any questions or comments? I know a lecture like this is like a avalanche, you know, like rolling down the mountain. Wow. We are blown out, information blown out. Maybe. Okay.
So sometimes we see that, especially in Christianity, they seem to have accepted the personality of God, the eternal dimension, but still they worship out of fear. Mm-hmm. They have fear of God.
Okay, in Christianity, yes, they still worship. That is, in the traditional Christianity, there was a personal concept, and at the same time they worshipped him out of fear. Then, as modern science came in, then Christianity withdrew on a second position because the church was very much challenged. So then they started to say, actually, this whole personal idea, that's just mythological for the simple common man, but actually the true understanding is that God is all-pervading love. And then we're back with Paka, with first-class Mayavad or impersonalism. So nowadays, in Christianity, impersonalism is rampant. But it started out with a personalist concept, absolutely. Because the impersonalist is thinking that he will, after we lose all this material identification, that we will become God at the end. Tatvamasi, you are that too. You are also that. So they say. So we are not... So that is the biggest false ego you could have, you know. I mean, you got people who are proud about being a bank director. But imagine somebody being proud about being a about being God. That's the ultimate pride that man can have. I saw yesterday a poster of Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali saying, the greatest of the greatest ever. Okay. I think yes, but Tyson was an animal. He was pretty good too. He would say to his enemies, before he started fighting with them, he would say, I'll eat your children. What an animal. Rakshasa. Anyway, so, but one of the things that he's God, he really thinks he's the greatest. even greater than Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali or Mike Tyson. Now it's your turn. Yes.
So Tyson also eats ears, but that's something
different. Oh yeah, Tyson, he bit off a few ears. Yeah.
So in Christianity, they have this Christ personality, right? So they have also a kind of person which is implied in Jesus when he is in the Jordan and he's getting baptized, and then he's like certainly he's God in a person, in
yeah.
physical form.
Yeah. But first of all, the understanding about Jesus, his position in Christianity, is now in the Western Church, in the Roman Church, it's by dogma been established that Jesus is God, right? And therefore the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and all that. But in Eastern Christianity, yes, in the Orthodox Christian Church, there is still a branch that is understanding that the Supreme, that Jesus is not God, but that he's the Son of God. Yeah. And this debate came to a major clash a few hundred years after Christ, somewhere 300-something. It came to a major clash in Constantinople. And there were two groups who were confronting. And then finally, they killed a particular governor who was preaching that Jesus is the Son of God and he's not God, and they drove out that governor of and then his party. They just lynched. It was a lynching mob, whatever they did, they killed. So then after that, Constantinople had the opinion that Jesus is God. There's an interesting book from a Jewish professor called Rubinstein, How Jesus Became God. Again, I can recommend it. It's interesting. Anyway, so we don't accept Jesus as God. Right? Islam, they also know Jesus. In the Quran, Jesus is described quite elaborately, but they don't. They say he's the Son of God. He's not God. We also will acknowledge that Jesus is the Son of God, but that he is the instrument of God, and that the Lord acts through him. And in this way, as an instrument of the Lord, he becomes almost like the Lord, just like iron, if you keep it in fire for a long time, begins to act like fire. It's not fire, it's iron. But it's so hot that it can burn anything. It's like, it's sort of merged with the fire, in a way. So in the same way, Jesus was so much united with the Supreme that he became his direct via media. There was no false ego. And in that way we recognize him as a Shakti of Ajavatar. But not as God. So in this way, but yes, Christianity has concepts in their scriptures of a personal God. And a little bit maybe still alive, yeah? But it's sort of mixed, you know what I mean? It's mixed with impersonalism. Because the same people, they will also think, yeah, but he is like the all-pervading love, the all-pervading supreme intelligence, you know, that's ultimately. If you really dig deeper, then that's what comes out, yeah? as the ultimate. So my point was, He analyzed it. They were worshipping the personal God, but not mostly out of fear. Of course, there were some Christian mystics, like Teresa de Avila and so on, yeah, who were completely worshipping out of love. Right? And they described, so it has a core also of worship out of love. But the general populace was worshipping out of fear, absolutely. So Krishna consciousness is offering that we approach a personal God and serve him out of love. That's the idea, right? Because he's the most wonderful person. Yeah, that's the idea. So in that way, Krishna consciousness is, that's why we see it as the ultimate form of spirituality. Who else?
I have a question. maybe I don't know if I can frame it properly, but
Hindi mein bata dijiye.
The when you said about the many deities on the altar. when I try to explain to my relatives and other people that the challenge or the question they ask back is, we also have, or within Krishna we try to, our attitude is like we want to serve this deity, or like Narsingadev or Jagannath or Radha Krishna. So we try to also have many deities on altar. And
not many, just a few. But Jesus is one person, not different persons. See, Durga is not Shiva. And Shiva is not Ganapati. They are different personalities. And Lakshmi is a different personality. And Saraswati is a different personality. Different. No? But Krishna and Sringadev, same person. Krishna and Jagannath, same person. Just another manifestation. Because why would God limit himself to one form? Advaita vachyuttam anadim anantarupam. He takes unlimited forms. And each form is also unlimited. So we have a few forms that we worship. But it is the same Krishna. Jagannath is Krishna. Narsingadev is Krishna. They're just different mood. Narsingadev is Krishna when he's angry. He was very angry with Hiranyakasipu. So he showed that angry form to protect his devotee, Prahlad. You would also become very angry if someone would attack your child. You would also look like Narsingadev. Anyway, so that's all Krishna. No, otherwise, we respect all the devatas, all the demigods. But the demigods, they cannot give us eternal life. Hiranyakasipu approached Lord Brahma for eternal life. He couldn't get it. So eternal life cannot be attained through the worship, not even of Brahma or Lord Shiva. What to speak of other deities. Therefore the worship of the demigods is karmakanda, is aiming, is worship that gives us material benefit. So therefore it is lower, as we explained today, lower form. Because you get material benefit. You do your worship and you become rich. Nice. And then you die. And then it's all finished. So what's the point? Yeah. So better you invest in worshipping the eternal reality. That's the idea. That's why we focus on Krishna. You tell the family. No, because sometimes they blame you. Why are you not doing this puja? Why are you not doing it? How can you not do it? This Shivratri, you must go to the mandir. No, you're insisting. Some marriage is there. No, we must do the pujas. Otherwise, this marriage will grow. No, ma, we don't need to do the pujas. We just worship Krishna. No. How can you do this? No, we must do this. Big dramas. So, I wish you well. Kechit kevalai bhakcha vasudev parayana. We are only dedicating ourselves, only to Krishna, Vasudev Parayana, only become Vasudev Parayana, in bhakti, bas, or kuch nahi. Hare Krishna. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.